Hi, I'm Dr. George Saltonis, and welcome to Medical Unnecessary, a Studies Area podcast series on the National Disability Insurance Scheme. Both of you, by the Summer Foundation. I'm coming to you from Wurundjeri land, and pay my respects to the traditional owners and elders, past, present, and emerging. But before we go any further, please do me a favor and hit the like button, subscribe to the channel, and select the notification bell so that you can be notified of future episodes. This is our second part of our deep dive into the changes put forward by the NDIS review. If you haven't seen the first part, check that out by following the link in the description below. In this episode, we examine three more of the biggest NDIS review recommendations, and we do it with advocates and academics who have analyzed the final report. We will try to explain what these changes might mean for NDIS participants, and you'll hear what our experts really think about the changes proposed. It might all sound a bit scary, but the good news is that the government has committed to co-design, and so it is important that we take the time to understand the serious issues outlined in the NDIS review and think about what we can do together to make sure that any changes to the NDIS work for our community. And with that in mind, let's get into it. Hi everyone, welcome back.
Hi George.
So good to be back with you to talk NDIS review and to really get in deep about what it all means. In our last episode, we looked really closely about the recommendations around mandatory registration. We also looked at the home and living recommendations. Today, we're going to examine three more of the recommendations. And Sam, let's start with assessments. My understanding is there's going to be functional assessments to build into the NDIS, and then needs assessments to work out the budget. Can you talk us through that, Sam?
Yeah, so it's a different process. They're splitting up, or recommending splitting up, the current planning process into three different bits. So it'll be about access, and then a disability support needs assessment, and then setting and using your budget after that. So a lot of it isn't really clear. What is clear is the difference between a functional assessment and a needs assessment. So it might be that, you know, the difference between Sam can't count, which is a functional assessment, versus Sam needs help to be able to use the bus, to catch it to work, etc. And so when we're looking at the disability support needs assessment, it's about, you know, what kind of life do I have? Do I go to work every day and therefore I need to catch the bus? Who's going to be able to help me, et cetera, et cetera? And so, yeah, it's a different process than the one that we're used to now.
My understanding is that, well, the functional assessment might be done by a doctor, but the needs assessment to the budget will be done by the NDIA or a contractor of the NDIA. So I can see the benefit of having people with the internal knowledge of the system, but I'm worried that the assessment might be biased or might not be objective if it's done by the government.
Yeah, and it's really tricky when we look at the way that we've been assessed in the past. You know, are we going to have people coming into our homes again? That was one of the things that people were concerned about. Is it going to be, how are people going to be able to understand what our lives look like? You know, how intrusive is it going to be for some people? There's really not a lot of detail about how this will look with the implementation. And the tricky part is, of course, is that it should be co-designed, and therefore that detail is necessarily missing.
Yeah, absolutely. And they are recommending that the assessments are co-designed. They're not recommending any particular assessments in the report, but they're saying that the community needs to work with the agency to co-design these assessments. I'm also interested in your views, Anne, because you're very qualified, knowledgeable person around disability and health. Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts on assessments?
Well, I think the devil's in the detail here, I think. So these are sort of high-level ideas, and I think what the implementation of that's going to be where the issues are. So the first part of assessing functional capacity, after all, we were always meant to think about functioning rather than particular so-called health conditions. And so far the NDIS has had a range of health conditions that they, you know, have on particular lists that enable, you know, access directly to the NDIS, and others that, you know, you have to demonstrate issues around functioning. So I think that's all the condition lists are being thrown out, and what we're meant to do is assess functioning. I think, again, there are no suitable tools to do that across the board for everyone. Just give you an example of what's been done for multiple sclerosis, something that's a condition that I have, where there are particular, you know, there's an extended disability scale, and you know, for people to get into the NDIS, you have to reach a certain score on that disability scale, which does assess different kinds of levels of functioning, but is weighted towards the kind of issues that someone with multiple sclerosis is likely to face versus someone perhaps with, a psychosocial disability, for instance. So creating a functional capacity tool that can capture the broad range of experiences that people with disability face across different kinds of areas of life is difficult. When we talk about functioning, typically we're talking about issues around self-care. So do you need support to, you know, eat, shower, dress? Communication, do you need support, whether that be by aides or, you know, particular aides or communication aides or support from other people about to communicate your needs? Mobility, you know, can you get around by yourself? Do you need aides or other supports to help you get around in the community? And social participation, what are the restrictions to social participation? So theoretically, that's based on what we call the International Classification of Functioning, Disability and Health, and I want you all to recite that at the end of it. So theoretically, a tool should do that. But what's really important is that someone can actually do pretty well on one of those domains. Like you, for instance, George, are going to score pretty high on communication, as is Sam. And so we need to work out how we, you know, weight those different areas. It's not at all clear to me how they will be able to do that across a range of different kinds of health conditions. And it's really what wasn't the only reason, you know, obviously independent assessments was something that fell, you know, happened for, had its own issues, but essentially that's what they were trying to do with independent assessments. But all along, there's no off-the-shelf, you know, so-called instrument that they can use. So my understanding is that they're going to have to work with, you know, a broad range of people to work out, one, if there's a suitable instrument and whether it really does capture the range of experiences and how they're going to use it to determine access. You know, I think it's a really good idea to get rid of the health condition list, although sometimes it does make sense to use. If someone, for instance, have a high spinal cord injury, you know they're going to have particular kinds of functional issues, and so you probably don't need a functional assessment in that case. For other more complex conditions, you need to perhaps get at that. So in principle, it's a good idea. The detail on how they do it, I have no idea, and the extent to which it's, you know, people are able to use their own practitioners or whether it's done by someone from the agency. They say that, you know, it's going to be a better trained person, they're going to be well trained. I don't know who those people are. The previous independent assessments used any kind of allied health professional, and people kind of told me horrific stories, you know, of a physio assessing communication needs, for instance, who really didn't have the skill sets they needed to be able to do that. So I think that's going to take a lot to design well. In principle, a good idea. In practice, I'm not quite sure how it's going to work. In terms of support needs assessment, I don't know anywhere in the world that has used an instrument to assess support needs, so we'll be starting from scratch. My comment on this is probably the area of the NDIS review that is going to require a lot of work, and I can't see it being implemented anytime soon. The other thing is that's not clear is how that support needs assessment will flow into a budget, which essentially is the second part of the step, that the support needs assessment will inform how much budget you are going to get. And that's going to be really, really important. So I guess the question with the support needs assessment is, you know, will be related to functioning, but it will also be related to the kind of other supports you have in your life, where you live, if you live in the country or the city, those kinds of things. So it has to be a very complex assessment. And in a lot of ways, that's the information that's already collected at the time of us, you know, looking at plan, you know, getting plans and plan review, but not in a systematic way. So I think that for me, the devil is really in the detail here. And I would hate to see this rushed and we end up with, you know, very poor ways of going about this. There's so much needs to be done. It's not being done, as far as I know, anywhere else in the world in the same way. And this is something we need to keep an eye on in terms of, it's a very high level recommendation, but, you know, it's changing. It is changing the way we budget, set and access. Probably a good thing, because that was very unclear, but how this is going to be implemented, I don't know.
Thanks, Anne. Helen, how do you turn a needs assessment into a budget? Like, what do you need to do that? Because one of the concerns is that people might have their funding cut. And I'm really interested from your experience as an academic, how do you see this working, Helen?
In some senses, I think the approach is moving it a bit closer to the approach that you see in England around personal budgets there. And I think, George, when you had Simon Duffy on your podcast, you talked a little bit about this, because he highlighted this has been an area that concerned him in terms of the NDIS. So he talked about many of the issues that are there in the review about people getting locked into plans that have things set out, you know, line item by line item. You don't have a lot of flexibility and can't do things in different ways. So he suggested and said, what we should think about is what outcomes do people want to achieve in terms of their lives? What kind of supports sit around people on a day-to-day basis? And then, you know, what sorts of things might people need supports with to give an indication of where you'd go with a budget? It's something I've spoken to Simon about a few times, because I similarly don't quite understand how you get through that process and come up with a kind of magic number that people will be able to use in a meaningful way to get those sorts of supports. The English system is different. They have a resource allocation system, but it's one that I guess we probably might look on with a little bit of concern, given in England, local authorities are responsible for giving people these budgets. And in the English context, we've seen local authorities have their budgets cut significantly. And that's meant that we've also seen significant cuts to budgets for people with disability and older people as well. So like Anne, I think kind of, you know, moving away from this system where we nail everything down line by line and then work the budget up from there, but don't allow people kind of flexibility around that, to one where we give somebody a more global budget that they can use a little bit more flexibly and in ways that make sense to them to support them in their lives is a really good idea. But the question of how you get from where we are to that is a real challenging one. So, I mean, I would be looking to see, you know, the government to make commitments, you know, like people with existing kind of NDIS budgets that they're happy with, that there'll be a commitment for nobody to see cuts as we move into a new process, and commit to kind of reviewing that over a couple of years, just to check that we're not seeing those sorts of reductions happen.
I'm with Helen. Line-to-line planning is not a great idea, but the question for me rises is, how do individuals challenge or ask for reviews of their budget? Because, you know, in the past, people have their basis for their review have been things like, you know, they don't have enough transport, or they, don't have enough therapy support, or there's not, you know, they need one-on-one support rather than, you know, a less intensive level of support and so forth. So they've gone to request those changes through, you know, what we called a review of a reviewable decision, a RAWD. And I know, you know, most of the people I know have been through a RAWD process. And then obviously if that's unsuccessful, which is also quite a few people, they will go to the AAT. So how do we do that when we're changing the way we do the budgeting? Because, you know, we're not saying you haven't got transport support, you know, but can you work? How do you say the budget envelope isn't enough for you? And what about
Anna, I think that you've nailed it there. I think that what the review is trying to do is to stop that process, because clearly if every line can be challenged, then there's a lot of appealing going on. And I having read the report, it essentially says that there's a lot of disagreements between planners and people with disabilities. So the response of the review is, let's make it a whole budget so that people can't appeal particular items.
Well, I think we've got to have a different process for appeal, people. And this is where system navigators will be important. How do you show that your budget is sufficient to meet your needs? And we're going to have to really think about that process. And it doesn't necessarily mean line-to-line planning, but it does mean saying, you know, is this sufficient to cover what I need to, you know, be independent, you know, get support in the home, to be in the community and so forth. So I don't know that the review is silent on that, and I think that's part of the process, because we don't want to lose the capacity to appeal the decisions that are made, and there needs to be some flexibility in the way support needs are translated into budgets. The other question too is, how do we do that? Do we do that every review? I think in some ways, when people's support needs are likely to be stable, there's not really much point in kind of repeating it. But at key transition points, say when young people are leaving school and so forth, that will be really important.
Yeah, no, thanks, Anne. It's a really good point that you raise. I think particularly in the area of psychosocial, you can imagine if someone was having an episode or not, when that person turned up to do that assessment is a really important moment. And unless it's someone that's really skilled and can ask what it looked like potentially a week ago or 2 days ago, capturing what life looks like over a longer period of time will be really, really important to get that budget right, because the risks, obviously, and certainly in my circumstance, it's the use of the budget is really fluctuating, but sometimes it's, you know, 20 hours a day and sometimes it's not at all. So you really do need someone that's really skilled in that space, who potentially can see you more than once, and can get other professionals who've seen that journey with the person and can talk to that.
George, I think it is possible to undertake a form of planning that looks at an individual's circumstances and translate that into a dollar amount. What I see here as a significant risk is that the agency for a long time and the NDIS review is essentially promoting the idea of a personal budget. And the origin of that original personal budget and how that is quantified is really ambiguous. And we know that the NDIA does not have any evidence to support the allocations of dollars that they do now. They certainly don't have any documentary evidence to clearly demonstrate that those dollars applied to that individual will lead to social and economic participation opportunities, definitely. And my overarching fear is when this is located within the agency, it lacks the transparency, that in exactly the same way that there is no transparency in decision-making now. Now, having said that, many of us on a daily basis are struggling with how to translate the supports that individuals require into some dollar amount. And I think that is It is possible. But as the Productivity Commission said, we'd really need to design a process from the ground up that the systems, as Anne has said, the systems, the tools that are available were never designed to assess an individual and translate that into a funding amount. And simplistically, what we do in this space is spend time with the individual, gain a deep understanding of the support they require on an hour-by-hour basis, on a day-by-day basis, with a starting point of what somebody needs assistance to do in those areas of function that Anne referred to through the international measures. But then we start to ask, what are these supports that this individual is likely to require in order to have presence in community, to be able to participate in community, to exercise choice, to have valued roles, and to make a contribution? And once we start asking those questions, we move from whether or not you can make a cup of tea to what is it that you need in your life so that you are able to connect with other people, for example, you're able to receive the assistance you require to mediate some of the anxieties that emerge as a consequence of your condition, for example. And these things emerge out of that time that you spend with the individual, and you begin to nuance this style of support away from just putting in a babysitter into somebody's life to thinking about what are the skills and characteristics of the support and those providing support so that those general five areas are beginning to be realised. And because we don't have any data that gives us clarity about what those key elements are, it's almost as though this suggests to me that there's an action research piece here that over a number of years, applying a methodology to understanding how we grapple with what people require in order to participate socially and economically, we're gathering some deeper insights, but we need that process to be more clearly identified and the key questions clearly identified in order to do that. Then it is possible then to interrogate that information and say, well, if we look at that, it is clear that this person requires support at this level, at these times of the day. And then we can start to overlay it with some questions about some of the interesting models of support that you might want to play with. So, you know, hosts and so on. Or you can ask the question, now we are wanting to ensure that this individual is able to make their journey out of supported independent living and group homes into areas of life where they have greater agency and choice and control over their lives. What are the sorts of models of support and approaches to support that this individual is likely to need to be present in their life in order to do that? And that kind of also dovetails into the navigators. So what I'm saying is it's possible, but this work worldwide hasn't been done very well, and it was always acknowledged right from the get-go that this needed to be a bespoke solution for this unique scheme in Australia. And I'd put in a plug again for the self-managers. The self-managers have been doing this for 30 years. So if you want to know how to do it, ask the self-managers.
Can I say one thing, Peter, though? The one exception to this process is the statement about the stuff we talked about last week is the intensity of, you know, sharing supports in the home and living environment where it's more specified now, where, you know, so that's the one exception to the kind of personal budget setting process, because that's a shared budget setting process, if you like. That's the one difference, the one example where it's not quite the same.
And I agree, and that is the contradiction in the recommendations. On one hand, here's a flexible budget to deploy according to your individual needs, but we're also recommending that there be the equivalent to a block grant. And those two things are not compatible. And I guess I'd be saying, we need to be clear what side of the fence we're on. Are we on the side of the fence of agency, autonomy and self-direction? Or is this just a simplistic response to putting a block of money around people and hoping that it'll all be okay and they won't suffer abuse and neglect anymore?
A little out of there, and when we look at those two recommendations, I don't think they can sit side by side very well together. I'm also thinking, because I was one of the participants in the pilot of the assessment, and one of the things that I found hardest and most confronting and concerning is that I hadn't met this person before, and suddenly they were asking me incredibly personal questions about my life, and I'll be very honest, it was traumatizing. I left the experience. I really didn't think, oh, this will be really, really interesting. I'm a researcher, I'm a policy person. I'm gonna have a really useful opportunity here to learn about this process. But I honestly left feeling like I had been traumatized. So we're going to have to be very, very careful in whatever is developed, that it doesn't harm people, and that it's a respectful process, and that people feel like it's fair and transparent.
George, can I just chip in on that? And I completely agree with you as somebody who has trauma background and PTSD as a response to that trauma. I think we all have a bit of PTSD from the NDIS and the various systems as well. I'm also very, very wary that when the impairment tables were brought in 2011, they'd ran this same line. They said it's going to look at what you can do, not what you can't do, and it's going to make things easier. And then when the detail came out, it was that, no, you're not. It's going to be harder for 40% more people to get onto the DSP. So I'm concerned about, you know, the detail of what this might look like in the end.
Thanks, Anne. Let's move on now to the recommendation to bring in system navigators and to phase out support coordinators. Anne, can you help us understand what they're proposing here?
Well, this is a complex area, and it's linked to the new concept of foundational supports. You know, previously, we talked about the people, you know, so-called tier two supports for people outside the scheme. Now, rather than that, they're talking about foundational supports, which are kind of general supports to such as information, and then more support around disability specific supports for both NDIS and non-NDIS participants. Well, foundational supports are for both NDIS and non-NDIS participants, but the specialised supports are where you need some disability-specific support. So for an non-NDIS participant, that's a very strange way of describing it. I'm a researcher. We have to have little categories that we label. And that really means they might get support with cleaning and so forth, but they mightn't necessarily have an NDIS plan. For NDIS participants or for people applying for the NDIS, it's about both accessing those foundational supports, but also support in, you know, applying for the NDIS and navigating the NDIS and other mainstream supports. So for the NDIS participants, it extends the role of a current support coordinator in many ways to bring in, you know, traditionally support coordinators are sort of there to help you navigate, work out services you want to do, use, help you plan and so forth. But there were many gaps in that system. And we also had, you know, supposedly if you were going through a LAC, we had the LAC planners. I don't know how many people were ever able to access their LAC planner. But they also had a role there. And then for some people, plan managers. And so, you know, I think it's sort of trying to extend that role. Also the other problem with support coordinators, it was very hit and miss. And it may well be for system navigators, I suggest, But not all NDIS participants had access to support coordination, and many had not enough access to support coordination. And so I think, you know, there was and a recognised need to reform what is currently called support coordination. Now, the challenge here is this is a really big job. And what the they've described a various types of navigators, which every person with a disability should be able to access a general navigator, which will help you, you know, access both what they've called foundational supports that are general and targeted supports. So the general supports are more, you know, information and that sort of stuff, whereas the targeted supports are more about access to disability-specific supports. And then they have a range of different kinds of navigators, from people that help you, for example, a general navigator or a specialist navigator who might be helping to support people who have complex support needs, such as people who need to access multiple systems like child protection and so forth. Then I think we'll talk about psychosocial recovery navigators, and then there's specific navigators to help people, NDIS participants, around home and living arrangements, and also what's a new role for people who share living, housing and living supports, as we discussed last week. Ideally, this is a great idea and should help people with disabilities. What I'm concerned about, I say, is this is a really big, big role. If you think about the NDIS is complex enough, think about how the NDIS does or does not join up with other systems, you know, because we're going to see, you know, the big question here is that states and territories are going to need to step up in terms of the supports they provide. And it's a complex system. Navigating a health system is complex. Navigating and bringing together disability supports, educational supports and so forth, and navigators understanding that complexity and where people can get the support is going to be incredibly difficult. The skill sets, I cannot imagine what kind of skill sets that person's going to need. I have kind of fairly deep understanding of both the health system and the disability system. I would be completely flummoxed if I had to also go through child protection, or the educational system as well.
I think it's just adding to that list, Anne, which is substantial. They also need to be local to their area. They also need to understand community and mainstream supports. And I think what many of us saw with the local area coordinators was a lack of understanding of what's available in your community. So, you know, if you got a good LAC that was local, then you did really well, because they might know actually what was around, if there was anything. So the ability to understand supported decision making and the roles of different nominees and enduring guardians, but also critically, I think that ability to, you know, build circles and bring community in is often a role that doesn't sit with people that know the other piece that you were just talking about. So blending a person together and finding this superhero is challenging. A great opportunity for workforce, but really challenging. And then who trains them as well? So, sorry, back to your point.
Absolutely. Well, I think the problem at the moment is that people don't get that assistance, and I think the review recognises that, and it also says that we need everyone to have access to that support. And if people have really complex needs, that they need specialised assistance. I do like those things. What concerns me though is that at the moment people can choose their support coordinator, and they can find one that they really like and hold on to them. But it feels like under this proposal, you're going to be provided with or allocated a navigator, and you're not going to have that choice and control over who does that role.
George, my reading of the proposal is such that I'm concerned that these navigators will essentially be bound into the same extension of the NDIA as LACs and early childhood partners are. And that as a consequence of that, they will lack the connections to the community, the freedom to be strong advocates and allies. And I am convinced that it is critically important for people, when they need it, to have a strong ally in their community who knows their community well, who knows how to navigate the systems of that community, including a good understanding of contemporary models of support, and that they are unambiguously on side of the individual. I'm troubled that the recommendation as it sits locates those people within companies where this work is outsourced to, so it becomes a business model, not a relational model, and that it is the agency that is dictating the content of what they will do, and even what are the skill sets. If I go back to the original concept of LACs, my observation was that while there were some recognised flaws in that system, my observations are that those people were embedded within the communities, had resources available to them, and were unambiguously allies to the individual. I also know, just because of the work that I do, that we already have a vast understanding within the community development practitioners, knowledge about what it takes to ally with people in community in order to support them to navigate complexity and in order to build their agency and autonomy and skills and confidence to take control of their own destiny. And for me, that was the, in my mind, that's the core focus of what I saw to be the navigators. And what I see that's come out of the review is a mismatch of ideas thrown together in an incoherent way that looks like it's attempting to head in the direction that I've just indicated, but has profound structural flaws that will deeply compromise the ability of those navigators to engage in the way that they need to be of benefit to people.
Yeah, that's a real concern.
Yep.
Colin, do you have a handle?
Yeah, just to say that there are models, as we've seen these sorts of things work before. And if you think about things like inclusive living centres that are led and run by people with disability, that are really embedded in their local communities. And I think if we saw navigators developed in a way that were located within those sorts of groupings, then that would be hugely advantageous, because for all the reasons that others have talked about in terms of being embedded in local communities, being there for the interests of people with disability, you could see that those sorts of centres are real assets in their communities. They can help not just people with disabilities, but for example, if you've got local employers who maybe want to employ somebody with a disability but don't quite know what adjustments they should make or how to have those conversations, you could have a resource where you could go and ask some of those sorts of questions. And excuse me, so I think there's models out there. I guess my fear, probably like Peter's, is in the history of the agency, I think we haven't seen a willingness to maybe contract with what would be, you know, thousands of organisations independently across the country to do that. There might be a temptation to fold up those contracts into, I don't know, four or five kind of bigger contracts that a larger organisation takes around there. But this is back to this point that Anne sort of talked about before around implementation. I think in a lot of the recommendations in here, they could be implemented in a way that could be really positive, could be really transformational for people within the NDIS and people with disability more broadly, or they could be implemented in quite a narrow way that would limit choice and would restrict kind of the ability for people to live the sorts of lives they want to do. So I think there's a version in here that we could see where navigators could be developed really well. And I think we've just got to make sure we kind of support that vision of it going forward.
Yeah, I think you're right, Helen. It could be really positive if we adopt a model where people with disabilities are are reading this work and that it's peer-led, that would be fantastic. Yeah. Our final topic is to look at the changes to the pathway for people who have psychosocial disability. Meredith, this is your area of expertise. Help us out here.
Thanks, George. And look, I think one of the first things is that people often understand that psychosocial disability has had quite a different experience in the NDIS, and that, you know, what it is it's a mental health issue that really impacts people's ability to self-care and interact with people and have education and employment. And it's really debilitating for people. And that this cohort traditionally are much older. Also, it's been really difficult for them to get access to the NDIS. And at the same time, a lot of funding was transferred from the psychosocial support programs, which this left chasms of nothing for people. So that's been the biggest challenge. So I guess just the kind of the lessons learned that the review brought out was really that participants who are in psychosocial disability continue to have this, you know, really significant lower rates of outcomes. So the first recommendation was around this new specialist early intervention pathway. And this is challenging. I think there was a suggestion that this be up for 3 years. And I think before we talk about that, we have to talk about language. And so the report really is suggesting that this idea of personal recovery is the same as overcoming disability. And this assumption that people with substantial psychosocial disability can recover their function within this early intervention period to the point where they may not need the NDIS. So I think that's challenging for lots of people. Also remembering that a lot of people for early intervention often don't come to the NDIS till they're 35 on and may have had an enduring mental illness since they were 13, 14, 15. So it's in terms of early intervention and what you're getting, that's a hard understanding for people about what it will bring. So there's a very, I guess, unclear pathway for people about what supports that will also include. And if that functional impact is so severe, then shouldn't that just be skipped and you just immediately go into the scheme rather than having to go through this early pathway? And so lots of people are thinking, well, isn't this segregating disability? Isn't this actually treating people with psychosocial disability? Although I've said at the beginning that there are some differences, but accepting that many, many people have comorbidities and you'll have, you know, people who are going in and out of hospital who don't have psychosocial disabilities, why does it have to be different? Certainly, if it means more access to more services to more people, along with all of the hopefully, resources and changes that will come from the states and territories, that's beneficial, and foundational supports will also bring that. But there is a question about why would you actually treat this section of the community differently? So what's different? You know, I know many people that having an opportunity to have some extra support at home and living will certainly help day-to-day life, but it's not going to increase their functioning. And when you look at the early intervention requirements in the Act, you know, it talks about that the supports for the person are likely to benefit them in reducing their needs for supports moving forward. We don't have any evidence of that they are likely to benefit them by mitigating or alleviating the impact of their disability. So I think we have to go back to evidence here about what evidence are we using to say, and look, it may be the case that someone who has an early entry and an early intervention experience actually has some changes, but I would suggest that most people will need to continue into the permanent NDIS route. And I think there's this interesting statement they keep saying around, doesn't matter if you're in or out, it will feel the same. Well, if it will feel the same, then why not make it the same? So what's different if you are going to early intervention versus you're immediately accepted into the scheme? There must be a difference. Otherwise, you just put everyone in the scheme, and those that didn't need it, you know, a few years on would then leave it and go back to foundational supports themselves. So I think that re-traumatizing, once again, of being assessed every 6 months, the episodic nature of psychosocial disability, that will be really challenging for people. And so why re-traumatize people? The timing of that assessment will be really critical. And the understanding and the skills of the people that are actually assessing you is fundamental in terms of the outcomes for that assessment.
There's clearly a lot of changes there, more regular assessments, and I think that what the NDIS review is trying to say is that if we can get people off the NDIS and get the mainstream support, then that's what they're trying to do. But, you know, it is concerning for some people with psychosocial disability that they worry that they will be kicked off the NDIS when they really need it. And
yeah, look, I think this relates to one of the key terms of reference of the review, which was around financial sustainability and the concerns that a lot of people could not get the support they need through any other mechanism or system except through the NDIS. And you've talked about how states and territories and so forth, other programs were closed down, which was really, really important. One of my concerns, so there was cost shifting, if you like, into the NDIS. You know, you could interpret this as cost shifting back to other systems. So in terms of the health system, for example, in terms of providing support for people with psychosocial disability. One of the challenges for that is they're very different systems. There's no out-of-pocket expense for the NDIS. There is considerable out-of-pocket expense, say, to access a psychologist or whatever through a mental health plan, and there's a limited number of visits. So many people with disabilities cannot actually afford the gap between what Medicare pays and what the psychologist might charge. And this is a real challenge, I think, in trying to shift, cost shift. You know, now we're sort of, the complaint was that costs were shifted onto the NDIS, and now the idea is to shift some of those costs back. From the taxpayer's perspective, it doesn't really matter what system they come from, you know. So we really need to think about if we're cost shifting to other systems, how much will we escalate costs in those systems and how much will be the out-of-pocket expenses for people with disabilities, many of whom live on quite low incomes or pensions and so forth. So, you know, that's...
I think that's a really, really good point, that cost shifting. But I actually see the merit in what the NDIS review has done here. Because what worries me is that if this all the costs get shifted onto the NDIS, then the community will want to, you know, cut out our packages. So if we can build up community supports and cost shift back to the health system, then I actually think that it is going to help people with disabilities.
I think we have to remember that the NDIS isn't funding the things that people, the other bits that people need. Just like when any of you go to hospital because you're in a wheelchair or you have other needs, the hospital system deals with that. There are many people with psychosocial needs who may not go to hospital, may not go to hospital often. And similarly, the people that, when we receive services with psychosocial, all of that health stuff was never meant to be and isn't funded by the NDIS. I have to make that clear. Psychiatrists aren't paid for. Like, those systems aren't paid for. In fact, often the NDIS, being on the NDIS, stops you accessing those sometimes. So this is about having, the reason they call it psychosocial disability is because it stops someone's life. It stops them being employed. It stops them being educated. It can truly limit the ability to belong and in your community, and your family can't work either. So it's that piece that I think we have to generalise that's similar across everyone. It's what do we need to live the best possible life we can.
Just draw one more connection. This particular cohort is the most vulnerable to exploitation and abuse through hostels and boarding houses and unscrupulous providers preying on this group. And the removal of improved livability from the SDA categories will disproportionately affect people with psychosocial disabilities and others for whom the need for SDA doesn't relate to physical accessibility. It relates to their ability to find affordable, accessible housing within the housing market and the public housing system. And so the removal of improved livability also is one of those things, therefore, that needs to be scrutinised and challenged. Otherwise, we are going to end up again with a significant number of people who require that sort of accommodation living rough.
Absolutely, and I'm so glad I stoked the fire there, and I absolutely respect the need for people with psychosocial disability to get the supports that they need through the NDIS. So what happens next? Helen?
So the review is basically a series of recommendations that the government needs to think about and think what it wants to take on board and how it wants to react to that. I would imagine there's a significant amount of activity going on at the moment because many of the suggestions require changes to legislation. And I would imagine that that legislation will be the government wants to put that through sooner rather than later, and I suspect before the next federal budget that we have coming up. So there'll be a lot of activity going on to get that legislation changed. A lot of the changes will need to be co-designed with people with disabilities. So there'll be, I would imagine, a number of opportunities for people to engage around that. And we've also already seen the announcement of a number of task forces set up to explore some of the different suggestions, like around the suggestion of mandatory registration for providers. So I think there'll be a number of chances to engage in debates around these issues and to shape some of these changes as they're worked out.
Absolutely. Make sure that you get involved wherever you can in all of these co-design processes. What I'm really pleased about is the investment in co-design. We've seen a large commitment of resources to co-design by the government and by the NDIA, and there's going to be a lot of opportunity to get this right and to also point out the problems and to make sure that the things in the review that were outright wrong or poorly developed are fixed. I think that's going to be critical. Just before we wrap up, I want to give everyone a chance to say some final words. How about I start with you, Anne?
I suggest it is important for us to get involved to co-design. I also think it's important to bring in the international perspectives where they've tried to do this before, so we learn from other, and WA, for instance, we learn from other systems and don't repeat the mistakes that they've made. And I think often we fail to do that in Australia. I think we're reinventing stuff and it's important. It's going to require the states and territories to step up. And what I worry about is the variability across the states and territories. And it's also going to require other systems to be accessible both in terms of affordability and various other access in terms of changing attitudes and so forth in those systems. So those are big tasks, I think, and I have to remember that we're competing for the same workforce.
Thanks, Anne. Helen.
I echo Anne's sentiments. It's a huge task, and I mean, they've really gone across the full range, I think, of issues and challenges that have happened within the system. And I think, from a very personal perspective, I think there'd probably be more wide-ranging in the potential solutions to that thinking in a more systemic way than I had anticipated at the outset of the review. I think the real challenge is going to be around making sure that the design fulfills the kind of best intent of the reforms and that the implementation matches that. As I said before, I think a number of these areas, you could design and implement the reforms in different ways, and they would be really variable in terms of whether they would serve the needs of NDIS participants or not. So I think getting involved in co-design is really important. I know that sometimes that's difficult because there's not huge levels of trust given some of the reforms that we've seen before, but it's going to be really important to engage and through that whole process and make sure that these reforms are implemented in really positive ways.
Thank you, Helen. Peter?
From my perspective, the review identified what the issues were. Those issues were already known. What concerns me is that the solutions offered appear to assume that if we do more of the same, we'll get a different outcome. If we do more regulation, we do more compliance, we'll get a different outcome. My other concern is that when I look deeply into the background of those recommendations, the evidence base is spurious and ambiguous, and not the sort of evidence that you would base significant recommendations that have the possibility of severely impacting the lives of people with disabilities. And in particular, I think a symbol of that is the assumption that you can benchmark a person's life against shared support. Shared support being an outdated, archaic, and discredited model of service delivery, and we fundamentally need to rethink that. Finally, I am concerned that we haven't yet seen a formal statement from the NDIA or the government about the process of co-design. And there are many indicators that say to me that the agency is already moving to implement those recommendations and that those recommendations are seen as a foregone conclusion. And even in the town halls, that's some of the messaging that comes through.
Thanks, Peter. Meredith.
Thanks, George. I'm going to say something positive because I think that any changes that create more access to more people with a disability to more support is a significant positive one. And so we've got to work really, really hard, as Peter said, to identify where we can have a voice, where everyone can keep putting their ideas and innovations and what they need and the outcomes they're looking for onto the table so that the recommendations can actually be shaped into something that make a significantly positive difference to people. And I think I just want to finish with Social Care Futures statement, which I from the UK, which is what keeps us all going, which is that we all want to live in a place we call home with the people and things that we love, in communities where we look out for one another, doing the things that matter to us. And that's our goal.
Beautiful. Thanks. That's a rather fan.
Everything that everybody else just said, especially around co-design, if people with disability aren't involved in this and directly driving this, and unless we hold the power in this, it's just going to return to the old system, and everything that is broken will continue to be broken. Town halls are a consultation, they're not a co-design process. I agree with Peter about, you know, needing to make sure we've got something that's articulated rather than this very vague process that's going on at the moment. You remember our old saying, nothing about us without us. It's never more true than it is right now. And the lucky last thing is that we people with disability vote. Whatever the outcome of this is going to be is going to be reflected in the next election, you know, who we decide to vote for. So I very much hope they get it right.
Thank you, Sam, and I want to encourage all our listeners and viewers to engage deeply with the NDIS Review. You've done so by listening to this podcast, and please speak up about what you like, what you are concerned about, and get involved in the co-design, because that is the promise that we had from the government, that whatever changes will be made will be co-design. So the door's been open, and we need to walk in there and get down and do the work. Thank you everyone for your time, and see you soon.
Thank you, George.
Bye, George.
See you.
Thanks,
bye,
George.
George.
Look at that. We'll do it.
We trained us at the end.
That's all we have time for on today's episode of Reasonable and Necessary. As you know, we love your feedback, so please share your thoughts with us in the comment section below. Thanks for listening, and until next time, stay well and reasonable.